In the reformed version?
No, the way it works now.
Technically, if you've seen Economics 101 textbooks, they give you the fractional reserve, and then they give this little thing called the money multiplier. And it explains how if you have a certain amount of money and you have to keep 10% of it, but you can lend out 90% of it. The 90% circulates to another bank who can lend out 90% of that money, and then it goes to another bank. So the multiplier effect over time will create a lot more money. But in theory, it's not true. And as a matter of fact, so many people have been on the internet and looking at these subjects recently that they've put so much pressure on the central banks that just about, I think it was roughly about a month ago, the Bank of England came out with a very substantial paper and statement which admitted that it's not true that banks loan other people's money. Banks create money. And pretty much what we teach in the textbooks is untrue. You can go online and you can find that reported to
us. Yeah, but you said that the Federal Reserve, that the banks are short of money. You said the Federal Reserve, they call it the Federal Reserve to get the money they need so they can make loans.
Right.
Why would they have to need that? Why would they need the Federal Reserve to give them money to make loans, and they're just creating out of nothing?
Technically, they need a certain amount of capital in reserves, technically.
Yeah.
But if they don't have it, it doesn't matter. They just simply borrow it to put it on their books.
So
they borrow it. Yeah. So it's just, it costs them next to nothing to add reserves so that it'll justify making more loans.
But they do need those reserves from the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, but they're paying like 0.00 something percent. It's almost free money.
They're not getting from nothing, right? They have something. They need something on reserve in order to print the money or to make the money, create it, right? They have to have something on reserve because they're getting money from the Federal Reserve in order to make these loans. It may be for very little interest, but they're getting it from them, right?
Also, understand it's all ex nihilo. It's just coming out of thin air. They need more reserves. They call up the parent Federal Reserve, says, look, our balance sheet is a little low. And Ben Bernanke or whoever said, no problem, we'll type a few entries in, we'll increase your reserves, and that's it.
They count the fictional deposits as reserves. When they make the loan to the borrower, and it's put into their bank, under probably their bank, probably not a different bank, it counts towards the 10% that the 90, whatever it is, they have to keep on record.
I don't want you to be overwhelmed by the details. Trust me, it's a scam. The banks will lend as much money as they want. They are not restricted in any way by the amount of deposits they have. They can get around that without any problem whatsoever.
Brett, when did Mr. Simmel write that quote?
To be honest with you, I don't know. No, that was the other quote.
Because he could have equally added there in a series of comments, he could have said, reserve requirements is also not the debate.
Yes, right.
Really, it's something that scholars and academics and big bankers try to put in the newspapers to confuse us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where they're focusing all their energy on, is arguing about what should be in reserve. Should mortgage securities be in reserve? You know, it's like, who cares? Because the system is what it is regardless of all those things. And who could have added that if he had known about that?
Okay, anybody else have a question?
I mean, the reserves are moved around for clearances at the end of the day, each day. They move from bank to bank.
Right.
And there's informal loans.
Yeah, there's clearing every day, every evening. Right. So,
I just wanted to add about reserves, because reserves can be very confusing. But I have a friend who's a national bank examiner, and I said to him, does a private commercial bank making these loans and creating money, do they have to worry when they make huge loans, that they have enough reserves? And he said, they have 1 month from the date they make the loan to find the reserves, either to borrow it, whatever they wanted to get it. So he said, in effect, they can make, in the moment, they can make as big a loan as they want. And that's from a national bank examiner. All of the too big to fail banks, federal reserve banks, are national banks.
Question?
Yeah, you said that you wanted the government to create the money.
Mm-hmm.
When the government creates this money, who do you want distributed?
Well, of course, those are interesting questions, and they are detailed in the NEED Act, which is only about 12 pages. But it specifies, first of all, it says 25% of the money that will be created will go directly to the states on a per capita basis. So 25% of the money will go directly to the states for the states' own discretion on how they would use that money. It also, it says in the bill that the money would be directed towards the common good and for things like infrastructure, to repair the roads, bridges, and highways, the civil engineers, National Civil Engineers gave like something like a D rating or something. To bridge. So there's a lot of work to be done on infrastructure, so a lot of the money would go for that. There also is a consideration there might be something we'll call a citizen's dividend. Might be a certain amount of money that was distributed to every individual on a per capita basis, which would certainly jumpstart the economy right away. So those are some of the things.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I want to ask about a couple of magical ideas that I read and heard. Number one is that the only entities that can own the stock, and in effect, the only entities that can own the Federal Reserve Bank are, for instance, Chase Manhattan, Citibank, although I've heard Deutsche Bank and others own the New York Fed, but we can't own the shares of the Federal Reserve Bank.
Yeah, basically that's correct. The Federal Reserve is a closed loop system. And the only entities that have shares in the central bank are the bank members.
Right. And the second magical idea, very similar, is that we can't borrow those reserve dollars, for lack of a better term. They're only used between the banks. You know they're not available to anyone else.
Right. Again, not to overburden you with the details, but it's two kinds of money that are floating around. There's ordinary money that people like you and I and businesses use, and then there's bank money. Bank money is, again, in a closed loop. It's only used within the banking system between banks to readjust their reserves from bank to bank, etc. The whole thing you heard about quantitative easing, where the government was producing $85 billion every month, they were simply creating bank money to bolster the bank reserves of all the weak banks. That money never went outside of the banking system, never went into the real economy. It just simply took a lot of the bad debts off of the floundering banks, and the public basically assumed those. And they got like a dollar on the, you know.
Lastly, it seems to me that if it can't be used, it can't really be a reserve. In other words, if we're worried about backing up the dollars that I have with reserve dollars, but yet those reserve dollars can't be used in the actual economy, you know, they're not really functioning as reserves.
The only concept of the reserve is that way back when the goldsmiths started lending out more notes than they had gold, the idea was that just to keep a lid on how many notes they would create, they say, we've got to have a certain amount of gold in our reserves backing it up in case people bring in the notes. But it's a fiction. But at this point, you have to understand it's a total fiction, because if you bring your Federal Reserve notes into a bank and say, I want to cash them in, the only thing you will get for your Federal Reserve note at a bank is another Federal Reserve note. That's the only thing. You won't get gold, you won't get wealth. All the bank will give you, if you give them $100 bill, they'll give you a different $100 bill. So, again, reserves are meaningless at this point.
Yeah, the banks are, the $85 billion a month that the banks are creating going to other banks and never make it to the regular economy. How is it possible for inflation to be what it is? I thought that was crazy.
Because when the banks are creating the 97% of the money, that money does go into the real economy. The reason that we're not experiencing massive inflation is because most of that money is going to asset price bubbles. Instead of going into goods and services and the cost of labor, most of that money being held by, for the most part, the 1% or the 10%, they're just simply using that to buy up assets like land, which is constantly rising in price. So most of that money never ever produces anything other than higher prices for assets like land. So that's one reason to explain why real prices have, the inflation rate for real prices has been as moderate as it has been. It's not moderate. It would have been a lot worse. Move on.
Thank you.
Third speaker is Alan Smith.
Okay. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Okay, so let me make this my here's some of it. Yeah. So this is a picture of our Mother Earth, the universe we live in, nature's gifts. Is how can we share them in a fair way? The name for that is the commons, which I would break down into two parts, the givens of nature and also the cultural heritage. So money can be considered a cultural heritage. Language, art, knowledge. Okay. Anthony, is this the one I don't think this is my current one. Is this the one I sent to you rather than the updated one? It's not easy to get data about land prices, actual land prices. I mean, you can get individual sales. When a vacant lot sells, then you know how much they're paying for that land. Or when they buy a property only to tear it down, only to tear the existing structure down, they're obviously spending all that money purely for the land. But this comes from a study that the New York Fed did, came out in 08, but it starts off mentioning that the Columbus Circle, you know, right at the corner of Central Park, the current Time Warner Center or whatever, that was a property that sold for $365 million, or about $2,500 per square foot of land. It tore down the existing building. And they came up with, look what was happening. These are average prices in the whole five boroughs. So, just from that, in that 7-year period from 99 to 06, price per square foot of dirt was going from somewhere in the 40s all the way to 366. So, meaningful increase over that time. So we're going to look at some more recent phenomena that are going on as we speak. I'm going the wrong way. There we go. So here's a picture of the High Line. We saw a little bit of video about its history at the beginning. There's a photo, some photos I shot with Ron's camera. We took a walk a couple weeks ago. This is part of the High Line from, as seen from 20th Street. Parallels 10th Avenue. Same spot, just a different angle. Construction. It starts at a little below 14th.
It's 500, I think, because we have 14th Street.
It's on, it's 20th Street. It's 500 West 21. It's a,
it says West 21st, right.
But it's, that
I'm
is
at
21st.
I'm at 20th and the entrance must be 21st.
Well, all this construction is now down at 14th Street, too, on the corner between
it's all
14th and 10th.
Yeah. Yes, the High Line has tremendously stimulated development, and what's that going to do, what's it all doing to the prices of land?
It's going to skyrocket.
It's skyrocketing. And what does that do to the average Jane or Joe?
It's going to push them out of the area.
All right, you got businesses no longer able to keep their lease.
The fat cats are going to take over.
You know, prices of apartments and so on going out of low income or even medium income people's range. This is the problem we're talking about. This is a picture of the Hudson Yards development, sort of the centerpiece of a whole far west side area that's going like mad now. It's been a rather more undeveloped area, sort of a lot of warehouses, not very high use, or, and remember, it hasn't been served by the train either. So anyway, they're going to build these huge skyscrapers over these train yards. There's a map of these buildings. Going up right now. It's called the South Tower. This one, North Tower. Oh, somebody asked who's doing this. There's Related. It is the prime developer along with another company called Oxford Properties. So these are, if you look at them now, I'll get to a picture. These are train tracks from the Long Island Railroad coming into the Penn Station, you know, a few avenues over underneath Madison Square Park. And there's about 24 or more train tracks wide here. They're going to build a massive platform. They're going to put in these huge caissons that are going to be like 4 to 5 feet in diameter. Drill down 20, you know, 30, 40 feet into the bedrock. 300 of those things. And build a big concrete platform. Concrete and steel, and they're building skyscrapers on these. They've started in March, the first caisson, and this building broke ground, I think, in December 2012. And this one has already broken ground. This one's already up about 10 stories. This is going to be a school. There are going to be 20 restaurants in this little space. They say there are going to be 40,000 people a day coming through this space. Here's the High Line coming up here, parallel to 10th Avenue, and then currently it's open to here, and then eventually the rest of this is going to open as well. It kind of curves around.
What street is that?
Oh yeah, this is West 30th. Thanks for asking. And this is West 33rd. And these two big square blocks from 10th Avenue, 11th Avenue, 12th Avenue are the East Hudson Yards and the West Hudson Yards. Now, this is also coming into it. Hitherto, there's been no real train service over there, like the Javits Center. You'd have to take a bus or a long walk, right? Because the closest train used to be 8th Avenue, right? The A and the C. Well, now they've extended the 7 train from Times Square here. And it's under 41st Street, actually, West 41st. And it's coming to 11th Avenue and turning south, going past under the Javits Center and going to be a station here at 34th Street. We serve Javits Center, we serve Hudson Yards. That's a $3 billion project the city is doing. It's slated to open later this year. It's been set back a couple times. First it was going to be June, then maybe it's November. Maybe it ends up being next spring or something, but the tunnel is already built. It's just a matter of opening the station. And that's a picture of what must be, that's at 34th and 11th Avenue. So that's probably going to be one of the exit entrance and exits from the train. Okay, now this is a map of Manhattan property. That you get from the Department of Finance website. And in fact, I thought I might just, well, let me step through this a little bit. these things are called, there's a borough block and lot system, how they actually assess property and tax land and tax buildings. So they identify the parcels by borough, then by block, and then within the blocks there are lots. So these would be blocks. These are the Hudson Yard blocks, block 702 and 676, and these are individual lots. This is a whole block, these are individual lots. It would be a lot number for a typical building, residence, view. Be one of these lots on the block. And I thought I might just show you that. I'm not taking too much time, but it's not really hard to do when you just go nyc.gov. /DOF. Oops, I misspelled it. So that won't work. nyc.gov/DOF for Department of Finance. Still got my misspelling. Sorry about that.
Access to the internet?
I use a different keyboard layout, I'm sorry. This one is...
If you arrow down, it's already on there.
Okay, so you get to the Department of Finance website, looks like this. And over here on the left, under property, if you want to go a little further from what I hope to make you interested in today, is to be thinking about our land and how we could share it more equitably. So I clicked on property, And now I get to here. And going down here under property data and lot information. And then there's, you can look up deeds for actual sales. You can look up property assessments and tax bills and so on. But what I'm showing you now is the tax map itself. So we're just going to click on tax maps. And then one more time, click on tax maps. And then one more time, click on current tax map. And you get to this. Now you can enter a borough block and a lot here, but you can also just enlarge it with the plus sign here. Move this over if you like. You can also move it up and down. I mean, this is all public information. What? The properties, you know, what their assessed value is, what they're supposed to pay in tax, and so on. So there's Hudson Yards, these two, the east and the west. Here's, you can see the High Line coming up. And here's the Javits Center, and here's that train station of the 7 train. That's compared with, what's this? That's 11th, 10th, 9th, 8th. That's the closest train currently. And those are long blocks. Those blocks are like three number streets.
Do they intend to make the High Line further?
The High Line does extend. It currently is closed off here at 30th, but it does. The actual train tracks do extend around, over. They turn left here over to 12th Avenue, and come up to 34th, and then turn back toward left, and those will eventually be open. So we spoke about the High Line. What would you think about the 7 train extension? How's that going to affect land values?
Well, that whole community is gentrifying, and it's a lot of brownstones too.
Sure.
Very gentrified.
I mean, if you happen to own a lot right here or something, right? Would you be glad that the 7 train is coming here?
Yeah.
If you're the owner. Right, because essentially, without lifting a finger, your asset's going up, right? Value of your property is going up. And it's the land, the location itself. It doesn't mean the building's actually appreciated. The roof is just a year older, the paint job's a year older, the plumbing's a year older. That's not appreciated. It's just the values of the land. That these things that the economy all around is doing is causing basically a windfall gain to just simply holding property. And this is the game we've got ourselves in, which is that's the way you make it, by getting hold of these things so you can reap those gains. But it's at the expense of an equitable and fair system, and it's at the expense of poverty and people being pushed out of neighborhoods and businesses and so on. Now I'll go back to my presentation. Okay. So we zoomed in. There's the Hudson Yards, those two big squares. South of the Javits Center, there's a bigger zoom. And I'm also gonna later on show you some photos and some data about three particular lots right here. This is 33rd, 34th, there's a McDonald's here. I have a couple photos of. There's the company Coach, their headquarters is here. They're one of the prime tenants that's going to move into the South Tower in the new Hudson Yards. Oh, these are, okay, so it's doing it itself. Okay, that's the eastern rail yard, the eastern Hudson Yard. It's all these Long Island Railroad trains. Here's MTA, here's a 99-year lease between the MTA, 4,000 yards, $1 billion, 99-year lease with an option to purchase, it says, with related in Oxford. Now that property I said we're going to take a look at, this is the McDonald's. Up here, there are three little lots. This, and this. This is only 75 feet of foot of street footage. Should be about like a fairly typical residential building. And on this side, there's 100 feet of footage. So these three little lots, a little bit of a story to tell, but this is a picture of them from West 35th Street near 10th Avenue. It's not on the corner, it's not a corner lot. See, and this is from 36th, West 36th, same lot. So it's currently truck parking for Penske trucks, apparently. Now, it just so happens that these three lots sold, the resolution's not too good here, is it? These three lots together sold for $88 million last December. Again, this is obviously not to keep a parking lot for some Penske trucks, right? So they're paying that much just for that space for its potential revenue, right? Why do people put lots of money into a piece of land?
I don't know.
What are they expecting to get for their money?
Increased value.
Yeah, they want a return for their money, right? So they're gonna flip it to somebody else, or they're gonna develop, make a building, and then who's gonna ultimately pay these costs in the last analysis? The tenants, right? And the store customers and so on. So this sold for $88 million and in 07, just 7 years ago, it had sold for these two of the three sold for $24 million and the other one sold for $13 million, so 24 and 13, about 37, about $40 million, a little less than $40 million, just 6 years before that sale. That was 07, that was 13, December 2013. So in 6 years, from $39 million to $88 million for a little piece strip of asphalt. Now, here's what the city, Department of Finance, the assessments on that property are. Too bad the resolution is a little, I don't know how many of you can actually read these numbers.
We can't, you have to read the numbers.
So I have to read them to you. I was going to do that anyway. But so these are the same three lots. What the city assessor's office calls the market value, $5.5 million. $5.5 million. That makes 11, right? And 1.8. Let's call it $13 million. So the city assessors say that property. This is current. This is for the fiscal year. Current fiscal year ends in June, I think. So they say it's worth 13 million, yet it just sold for 88 million.
Are these lots with buildings on them?
No, that's a, those pictures I showed with...
Flat, right?
This. It's 75 feet on one street, 100 feet on the other. A couple hundred feet from the one block to the other. Okay, so the city says they're worth 13 million. Then since they're a class 4 property, I'll get into a little bit of the tax classes as time allows. They take 45% of what they call the market value, and then that's the value they use as the taxable value. So then they apply the tax rate to that. And there's yet another line, which is a transitional value. If there's a change, then they allow a transition. So class 4 was taxed at 45% of these rather unrealistic values. These are the four tax classes. Class 1, by the way, that percentage, class 1 is 1, 2, and 3 unit residential. Class 1 and 2 are both residential. Class 1, it's kind of an arcane system, but this is what we have in New York City. Class 1 is 1, 2, and 3 unit residential, and this level of assessment percentage for class 1 is 6%. For the other three, it's 45%. So class 2 is also residential, but more than 3 units. Class 3 is utilities, and that's a very small portion of the properties. And then class 4 is all the other commercial and industrial. This is in there. Again, I could go through the website and show you, but you click into under property data, and you go into definitions or terms, and under that page, this is where they define this level of assessment, the percent of so-called market value used to calculate your property's assessed value. For class 1, 6%, for class 2, 3, and 4, 3%. So here's the tentative assessment role for the upcoming fiscal year, starting July 1st. Tax lots, this is land. Residential units, this is buildings. Okay, so both are taxed.